responsibility for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll discuss the benefits of collective bargaining with Americans for Democratic Action National Director Michael J. Wilson. We'll also close out 2011 with two of our favorite interviews, MSNBC's Ed Schultz and Congresswoman Karen Bass. Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com, joined again by Michael J. Wilson, the National Director of the Americans for Democratic Action. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Jason. My pleasure.
An important topic that we're dealing with now is one involving the Machinists Union, who recently reached a new four-year collective bargaining agreement with Boeing, ending a dispute that saw the National Labor Relations Board file a lawsuit against the airplane manufacturer for an alleged violation of labor laws. What is your reaction to the new deal and all of these intricacies involved?
So I think the answer to my analysis of the deal is that collective bargaining works. Collective bargaining is hard. It's not easy. When you have, you know, employers and employees who have sometimes not the same goals, and trying to work those out and trying to have an analysis and trying to reach accommodations and sometimes even reaching a compromise. It's not easy. It's not easy between two individuals, and it's certainly not easy between an employer and their employees. But I think this is a case that we can show that collective bargaining works. The situation you described was an interesting one and a little bit unprecedented in that what had happened is that the Boeing had really tried to run a corporate campaign to try to influence collective bargaining, and the CEO of the company had actually been out in the press. I think he was on the radio talking about how he might move to South Carolina. He was using that as a lever in collective bargaining, and I think they hadn't thought that through. I don't think they realized that was potentially a violation of law. And the lawyer for the NLRB, when presented with this evidence, with these facts, really didn't have much of a choice. They really had to sue the company for violating the law.
You mentioned that it was a corporate campaign,
right,
on the part of the company. What does that do to the morale of the workers who are there every day doing the work and doing the jobs?
Well, I think it's always demoralizing for workers to see their company, the place they work, you know, the company that they give their sweat and toil and brains to all the time to make them successful, and to see that company essentially turn on them and say, no, we're not going to share with you in the way that you think we should share with you. I think there are better ways to communicate about collective bargaining and over the bargaining table. And sometimes those can be very tense, and sometimes that can be very direct. But when you step outside the bargaining process and you go to the broadcast media and you say, this is what we're going to do to you, and expect that to not have a repercussions is foolhardy and doesn't help in collective bargaining at all.
Let's talk a little bit about the NLRB's role in this situation.
Right.
Why was it that they became involved?
Well, I think when presented with the evidence of what had happened in the Boeing case, and I'm not sure if they were presented by the union or by someone else, my understanding is that in a lot of cases like this, you know, anyone can present the evidence to federal agencies. It's sometimes a competitor. It's sometimes somebody from the public. It sometimes is the union. It can come from a variety of different places. In this case, I think it did come from the union. But I think when presented with the evidence, the agency didn't have much choice except to say, you know, this is a violation of the collective bargaining rules. You know, when you have an existing union agreement, you can't use the threat of moving to another country or another state as leverage in the negotiations. That's not permitted. And so Boeing, having been caught doing what was clearly outside the scope of the law, attempted to continue to use extra legal methods to try to get beyond that. So they went to the Congress and they fought the agency, saying the agency shouldn't do this. As you know, I wrote an op-ed about this, which was broadly distributed to a lot of places. And I was surprised. Well, maybe I wasn't really surprised, but I was a little taken aback at some of the hateful comments I got, particularly from folks in South Carolina who should have realized that they were being used as tools in this. And, you know, they were complaining about how can you, support a, you know, the union over a right to work state. Can't you have a right to work state? Well, I may not like it, but yes, you can have a right to work state. And that's not what was going on here. This was clearly Boeing trying to play one side against the other, workers against workers.
And in that op-ed that you wrote, you said, this case is about whether corporations that decide to ignore the law, break the law, and intimidate workers can get away with it.
That's right. So Boeing had allies. You know, the senior senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, was an ally of theirs completely in this and, you know, went to the board and complained to the board and tried to not let the board do this. He introduced an amendment in the Senate to try to prohibit the board from doing its job. I mean, this was clearly extra legal attempts. In fact, I think there's also a lawsuit by the union against Senator Graham for his efforts here, which were clearly outside of the main. The role of the NLRB in this is to be the cop on the beat. It is to make sure that the law is adhered to. It's workplace law enforcement. That's clearly what they're trying to do here. And for and essentially for the sheriff on the beat to have the city council, like, you know, Senator Graham, say, don't enforce that law, I don't like that law, is untenable. It really is. I mean, the law is there. You may not like the law. He certainly has the right to change the law as an elected official, but the existing law has to be enforced.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Michael Wilson, National Director of the Americans for Democratic Action. Michael, now that the four-year collective bargaining agreement has been reached between Boeing and the Machinists Union, what's next?
Well, I don't know all the details of the agreement. It hasn't been ratified yet, but presuming that it is ratified, I think, first of all, we have to publicly acknowledge the success of collective bargaining in spite of all the outside efforts that were made from the Congress, from the company, and from others. I think we have to acknowledge that. Secondly, I think it's up to Boeing and to their union, the Machinists, to figure out how to move forward from this. Collective bargaining always is hard and does tough things to people. But beyond that, they still are working together. The union has every incentive to want the company to be successful. The company has every incentive, now that they've reached a collective bargaining agreement, to try to appropriately share with their employees so that they can be together successful jointly. I think it really is kind of moving forward here. And I don't know whether the agreement deals with the lawsuits or deals with the NLRB complaint. I think it potentially does, but I'll leave that to the parties to resolve. And I think that's the main thing here. The parties themselves have to resolve these issues.
Now, speaking of the NLRB, the board recently voted by 2-1 to speed up union elections and prevent challenges from holding those elections up. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, this is a case that we want workplace democracy to work and to be successful. And I think the NLRB's role is not to say we want the union to win every election or we want the company to win every election. I think it's the NLRB's role to say, what's the right way to have an election so that the workers' voices can actually be determinative, whether they want a union or not? And I think their attempt here is to try to get through some of the pre-election lobbying that a lot of companies do, and they hire consultants to do, which kind of prevents the election from going forward. And what happens in that time between when you file for an election and when you actually have an election, and having worked for a union and having been in that situation myself, the things that happen to workers are in lots of ways really, really intimidating and destroy the potential for having a real election.
Now, all of these things that we've been talking about so far today sort of lead into a broader issue, which happens to be the attack on workers' rights in this day and age. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we've talked about it very clearly at Americans for Democratic Action. I think that for organizations like ours, which are not predominantly labor organizations, it's incumbent upon us to speak out and say what's really going on. There's a war on workers going on in this country. Employers, public sector employers, private sector employers feel like now is our opportunity to try to get rid of this and to not let people have a voice at work, whether it's through threatening to move jobs to China, whether it's threatening to move jobs to non-union facilities or to right-to-work states, whether it's to use the state legislature and the governor's office to try to eliminate collective bargaining. There is a wholesale attack on workers' rights, which you'd have to be you know, completely ignorant to not see. It's happening at every level, at every union, in every workplace, in every industry. And the challenge is for workers to try to survive that is difficult, and it's just a tough time.
Why do you think knowing how valuable workers are to an organization, to a government agency or service, that they are under attack, that some legislators want to strip away some of those rights?
I think that there's always been an undercurrent by many people, particularly wealthy people or corporate owners, to try to have their way. They don't want to have collective bargaining if they don't want to. They'd rather just make decisions. I think they'd rather be able to pay people what they want to pay them rather than setting up pay scales. I think they'd rather be able to hire who they want to hire and fire who they want to fire, you know, without having laws tell them they can't discriminate in any kind of way. You know, there's an old saying, and I've forgotten who it was, who used to say, yeah, I can hire half the working class to kill the other half. And there really are people out there who believe that what they want to do is more important than what anybody else wants to do. And for those of us who believe that when we work together, when there's collective action, when we can join together and make decisions in a helpful way, that's the antithesis of what we really think this country is all about.
And do you see organizations, particularly yours, the Americans for Democratic Action, as one of the leaders in standing up for workplace democracy?
Well, it's clearly built into our DNA. You know, when ADA was founded back in 1947 by Eleanor Roosevelt and Walter Reuther and others, the goal was to keep the New Deal alive. And I think the New Deal goals of workers' rights, of basic benefits, of health care, of jobs, is ingrained in that. And you can't have that unless you let workers have a voice at work. You cannot have it otherwise. People have to have a right to have a union if they want a union. And that's part of what we do. I don't want to claim that we're one of the leading organizations. I know there are lots of organizations that believe that, but we clearly have believed it for a long time, and we continue to do so.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue with Americans for Democratic Action National Director Michael J. Wilson.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Continuing now with Michael Wilson, the National Director of the Americans for Democratic Action. Michael, 2012 figures to be a very, very busy for you at ADA. Talk about some of the events that you have going on.
Well, as you know, 2012 is an election year, and it's an opportunity for us to both encourage people to participate in the process and also to educate them about the process. So we're going to start right off the bat in Iowa on the 3rd of January. You know, I know there's a Republican presidential caucus that's going on, and they have lots of candidates who have lots of ideas. And there's a caucus on the Democratic side, but it's probably not going to be contested. I suspect the incumbent president, President Obama, will do fine and will not have real opposition. But when the Iowa caucus happens, it's an opportunity to really focus people's minds on the issues that are going on and the things that are going on. We're going to do an event we are calling the Hawkeye event, focused on working families. And we're going to have our Representative Keith Ellison from Minnesota, who's going to participate. We've got Celinda Lake, who's one of the leading pollsters in the country. We've got a state senator, Joe Bocum, who heads a national organization of state legislators. And we've been talking to the NEA about their president coming and talking and being a part of that panel as well, because we want organized labor to be part of that. Our goal is to be able to have a conversation and to talk about issues from a progressive perspective. You know, not just talking about building electrified fences to keep people out, and not talking about getting rid of health care and all the things that have been going on thus far, but to talk about issues that really affect working families. And we think that the press will look at that as an opportunity. to be a part of that conversation. And my suspicion, and I'm hearing this because people are really want to come to this event in Iowa. They're tired of the other red meat that's being thrown out there, and they're looking for an opportunity. They really want an opportunity to talk about issues that are really important to them. Kitchen table issues about their jobs, about their health care, about their retirement. That has been largely ignored by most of the people running for president.
If people in Iowa want to participate, or even those out of the state who may want to travel in and be a part of these events, how can they learn more?
Well, you can either go to our website for the Americans for Democratic Action Education Fund that's being put on by our Ed Fund, or you can go to our Facebook page for Americans for Democratic Action's Education Fund, or you can contact us at Americans for Democratic Action. Our website is www.adaction.org, or you can actually contact our office. We'd be glad to try to talk to people about that. I can give the number if you'd like, 202-785-5980.
Now, I also understand that you'll be tailoring some events around the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. Tell us about those.
Right. So our view has been that Dr. King's legacy is not as has been described by many folks. I mean, there's nothing wrong with service, and many people are focused on Dr. King and his service. You know, cleaning up schools and painting schools are all good things, but Dr. King was about much more substantive things. Dr. King died in Memphis, Tennessee, fighting for garbage workers who wanted to have a union. You know, lowly paid public sector garbage workers who wanted to have a voice at work. And that's when he was killed. Dr. King was about substantive things, about peace and about justice. And we've tried to recognize that. This is the third year in a row we've had our event we call WWMD, What Would Martin Do? What would Dr. King do if he were here and now working with us? And in conjunction with that, we're having an essay contest. And we've asked the people who want to participate, and anyone can participate. This is not just for young people. This is for anybody who wants to put pen to paper or computer and submit it to us. The question is, if Dr. King were here, imagine a conversation between Dr. King and President Obama. And I think that leads to lots of creative outlets for people, lots of opportunities for them to talk about the issues of today and the way Dr. King tried to frame them in terms of peace and justice, in terms of workers, in terms of racial justice as well. He was very clear about his vision. And, you know, we're not there yet. But I think it's incumbent upon those of us who share that vision to try to talk about it in a very modern way.
What was Dr. King's influence on you as a person?
Wow. That's very hard to say. If Dr. King, my father, who is still alive, was the same age as Dr. King. And so I feel very badly for Dr. King's children who didn't get to see their father as he grew up as an activist. I feel very badly that we didn't have more years of his leadership, of his very careful thinking, his very strategic mind about the ways that we can deal with the issues of today. I mean, I can't imagine a Dr. King and a Nelson Mandela engaged in conversation about how to move the whole world forward. I can't imagine how Dr. King would have been helpful in the discussions about the labor movement today. I mean, he had very strong views about labor, and they are sometimes, you know, taken out of context by those who don't support labor. But Dr. King was very clear about what he thought about organized labor. And when we do our What Would Martin Do event, we always have at least one person from labor on the panel to talk about this and to bring to fruition, you know, how Dr. King would deal with today's current issues.
Now, when we look at labor and employment issues around the country, clearly we're still faced with an unemployment problem despite the latest numbers that showed that the situation was improving.
Yeah.
It's still very dire for a lot of people, with a lot of people underemployed, unemployed, simply out of work.
Right.
What are your thoughts on all that?
So I'm glad it's getting better. I don't want to take anything away from the progress that's being made, but no one can be satisfied with this progress, and I know the president's not. You know, there are more than 14 million people who are without work and who are looking for work and who want to get a job and be able to support themselves and their families, and that number is a tragedy. One of the things I've said recently, repeatedly, is I'm so unhappy about the young people who I've had come through as interns, who are so smart, who are so talented, who are so, you know, connected to the social media and are just really interested in issues, and they're not getting the opportunities that they need to get that first job, that important first job to get into the workplace and be able to do the things that you and I and others are doing. It's just, it's a tragedy, and it's a loss for our country to not be able to build them up.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Michael Wilson, National Director of the Americans for Democratic Action. Michael, how does that unemployment affect young people, not only in the short term, but throughout their careers, not landing that first job that they really wanted?
Well, whenever they get their first job, it's their first job. And so if it's delayed 5 or more years, you know, they have lower lifetime earnings. They're going to have lower retirement possibilities. They're going to have those lost years in the beginning where you do trial and error, you make mistakes, but you learn. That's just going to be delayed. And so I think for them, it's a case of an extended childhood almost, because, you know, no one wants to, in some cases, you know, go away to college and have to come back home and live with mom and dad and, you know, work a part-time job and not be able to do the things you really, really had planned on doing in your career. And so that's really bad for them. It's bad for their parents. It's bad for their neighbors and their communities that we're not utilizing the skills and energy and talents of these young people. And we have to do it. We have to find a way to do it. So on that note, I tell you real quickly, Representative McDermott has introduced a bill on our behalf, which would, something we call the core budget, which would double the funding for the Job Corps, the Peace Corps, and for AmeriCorps. It's not an end-all solution for all of these, but it's a good way to give people that first experience, that first job, in ways that can help us.
Do you see the investment in infrastructure as a way to possibly help not just young people, but all workers looking for a job, looking for a career to make their way through life?
Well, absolutely. I mean, infrastructure is good for three big reasons. First of all, we need it for our country. I mean, anybody who sees the roads and the bridges and the public infrastructure of our country degrade over the last 10 to 20 or more years, you know, things that were built in the 1940s were built well, but they weren't built to last for 100 years. And so we need to do that for ourselves. Secondly, the jobs that can come from that, the construction jobs, are precisely the kind of jobs that many young people need. Everybody's not going to college. Everybody's not going to be the president of their company or going to be doing, you know, a variety of things. Construction jobs are good jobs, are helpful jobs, and can help move the economy forward. And so for people to be able to get that kind of work and to do necessary work for our country is good for them. And lastly, you know, the problem that we have with the deficit and the debt is mostly because we have these 14 million people sitting on the sideline. If they're working and paying into the system and paying taxes and helping to rebuild our federal infrastructure, that's the way we can really solve the problems of debt and deficit for our country.
Earlier in the program, we talked about this attack on workers' rights.
Right.
How have you seen that penetrate into the public sector workforce?
Well, let me recognize the success of organizing the workers at the airports, the screeners. I mean, for many years, some people, some elected officials, some ideologues fought against letting them have an opportunity to unionize. And, you know, I don't want to guess the outcome, but I think if you give people an opportunity to make their own decisions, they can make their own decisions. And so when they were unionized, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, the biggest union election this country has seen in decades, thousands of workers become union members because they wanted to do that. That's a historic thing. And I think AFG needs to be recognized for that. And I think organized labor needs to be recognized for that. And the workers themselves need to be recognized for making a historic opportunity come real. Your question, however, about the impact is that is one wave in one direction when we're seeing a tsunami in the other direction. And so, you know, when the governor of Ohio attempts to take away collective bargaining rights from public sector workers, police officers, firefighters, teachers, and others, and is rebuked by the population, you know, that's a victory for us that we have to celebrate. When the governor of Wisconsin, you know, does everything within his power to try to take away collective bargaining rights for public sector workers, and in essence, blaming public sector workers for the economic catastrophe that we find the country in, you know, that is so incorrect. And I know there are political things going on right now to try to recall the governor for what he's done, and I'm very supportive of that. I think that that's a recognition about some of the things that we're faced with, whether they're governors in Michigan and Florida and other places. People feel like, I think people who are opposed to organized labor see blood in the water, and they're looking for an opportunity in every case that they can to try to chip away at the hard-earned rights and benefits that people have gotten over the last few years.
Michael Wilson, National Director of the Americans for Democratic Action. Thank you so much for your time. Always great to have you on the program.
Thanks, Jason. Glad to be here.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll look back at one of our favorite interviews of 2011 with MSNBC's Ed Schultz.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
With me now is Ed Schultz, host of MSNBC's The Ed Show. Ed, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you. Thanks so much.
So what are your thoughts on the assault against unions in the middle class in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's part of a larger picture. This has been the playbook for the Republican governors that have gotten together. They want to attack wages. They want to attack the middle class. They want to balance the state budgets on the backs of those who are vulnerable and don't have representation. And the best way to make sure that they don't have representation is to go out there and destroy unions, knock out collective bargaining, attack public education, attack the public sector. And what is so inherently wrong about all of this is that they have delivered tax cuts to the top 2%, delivered tax cuts to the big corporations, and there's just a real grave inequity when it comes to sharing the burden. And when I've been on the road, that's really the phrase that I hear a lot of from Americans is share the burden. And what's interesting now is that there are numbers out there, consistent polling, that the governor of Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and New Jersey, they're all slipping in the polls. And they are really reaching too far, and the people are responding to it. So this could be a real political opportunity for the Democrats. And by default, the president could, in some key states, the ones that I named, especially Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, these are key swing states in many respects for Obama's reelection. These guys are shooting themselves in the foot, and President Obama and his reelection team could be the beneficiary of all of this. They're going to be able to go out on the campaign trail and say, you saw the Republican radical agenda. They tried to take X, Y, and Z away from you. We're not going to do that. We're about investing in America. So I think the narrative is being played out very well for the Democrats right now.
I've heard a lot of people ask the question, how does stripping collective bargaining rights from an employee somehow balance a state's budgets?
Well, first of all, when you have an opportunity to bargain collectively, it's strength. And you can go in and you can get a better health care package, which is fair. You can get a better retirement package, which is fair. You can get better wages. You can recognize, teachers who have invested in their careers, who have advanced themselves and produced. But these governors have come in, and they have broad-brushed public education. And one of the reasons why they're going after public education, it helps them on both ends. Number one, it helps them cut the budget right away because they can broad-brush. It affects every district and every county in their states. And also, they can push privatization, which the Republican agenda is truly all about. So across the board, the easiest target for all of these governors is education. It's easy to vilify. It's easy to find statistics that aren't working. It's easy to go in and pick on people that don't have the representation as far as the population is concerned. You can pick on minorities because they don't have any money or political pull. And so collective bargaining really is the benchmark and the foundation which supports wages across the board, whether you're in a union or not, whether you're involved in collective bargaining or not. And I think that the Republicans have recognized that this, once they have power in both the House and the Senate in their state legislatures, you know, they can fast-track this agenda. And I think we're seeing, well, the demonstrations, the pushback in all of the states.
With that, with the demonstrations, with the pushback, do you think that some of these governors and states that you mentioned earlier, like Michigan and Ohio, et cetera, will tread more lightly going forward, or do you see them just making an all-out push on this?
No, I don't think they're going to back off. I think they're willing to go make the case. They have drawn their line in the sand that they're anti-union, that they're anti-collective bargaining. They've shown that in the way they've set up their tax structure. I mean, what this governor in Ohio has done is borderline unconscionable. After what we've been through on Wall Street, we did this story last night on the Ed Show. After what we've been through on Wall Street, this guy wants to take liquor revenues, stick them on Wall Street, and try to make money off it. All he's doing is lining the pockets of his buddies on Wall Street so he can get reelected. Instead of playing it safe and conservative with the state's money, he's really putting the taxpayers at risk. For his own advantage. And, oh, by the way, he's getting rid of the creative economic development program in Ohio, which was run by the state, and turning it into a privatized effort of Jobs Ohio, and the governor named himself the chairman. I mean, how heavy-handed is that? And they want to know why these people are falling in the polls? They're falling in the polls because they're driving this country to a, you know, two America situation, the haves and the have-nots. So, look, they all made, you know, campaign promises to make the tough decisions. But when you start taking away from middle-class families, when you start taking away from people and giving tax breaks to the top 2%, that's what this is all about. This, the shared sacrifice is not there.
This is AFGE's Inside Government. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and I'm speaking with MSNBC's Ed Schultz about the attack on the middle class in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Ed, why is a middle class so important, so valuable to this country and our future successes?
You have to have a strong portion of the population with discretionary spending power. Discretionary dollars run our economy. And if you don't have discretionary dollars, which the middle class has had for generations in this country, you're going to run into a real economic problem. We're seeing it right now with high unemployment. Who knows what the number is? Labor Department says just under 10%. Every time I say that on the radio or TV show, I just absolutely get pounded with response from viewers saying, no, it's 15 or 17%, plus the ripple effect. And we're supposed to accept this new normal. We do not have a tax problem. We have a revenue problem. We have outsourced so much in this country, in our economy, which has attacked middle-class jobs and middle-class incomes. These are the jobs that have been shipped overseas. These folks have not been able to recycle back into the economy. We've lost our manufacturing base to any competitive advantage. And this is the new normal. Well, that discretionary income, our economy is a long way from bouncing back unless you reinvigorate the economy and get a better employment number and start manufacturing goods again. But when you've got an attack on labor, when you think someone who manufactures something is making too much money and you can do it somewhere else, and you lose your economic loyalty to the country, there's a downside to all of this. And we're going to lose our middle class. And in fact, it's going to take, years for us to recognize what we've done. You have to recognize the problem first. Then you have to have a plan to fix it. And then you have to act on it. And we're not doing any of those things. And President Obama wants to, but the Republicans don't see it his way. And this is what the gridlock is all about. What these Washington politicians don't understand is that their gridlock is hurting families. They don't want to give – we're ideologically stuck in the mud. They don't want to give in on anything. And this is a real travesty. And now, of course, you've got Citizens United, that ruling with unlimited funds coming into campaigns. Who knows where this is going to end up? The Republicans are sitting there thinking, well, you know what? We don't have to budge. We got tons of money coming in. We got the advocacy groups with unlimited funds, this ruling by the Supreme Court. We could just stick our ground. We'll get what we want. There's some pretty dangerous stuff going on, I think.
In terms of national politics, as it relates to the situation in Wisconsin and some of those other states, would you have liked to have seen more of a national response in support of the middle class workers?
Well, you know, yes, I would have. And I still would like to see more involvement by the National Democrats on this. But I think this happened so fast. You know, Harold Schaitberger, who is the head of the International Firefighters Association. You know, when I was in Wisconsin, this was about over a month ago, he says, Eddie, I tell you what, he says, this is coming at us fast and furious. And it caught a lot of people off guard. And I think behind the scenes, Republicans had a game plan of what they wanted to do once they got in. And this is how they wanted to do it. And there's a lot of coaching going on. You know, you can't tell me that it's a coincidence that all of these governors just happen to be attacking the same things. This is part of their game plan, their playbook. But it has happened so fast, and it's been so radical. It has awakened a sleeping giant in this country. And ironically, they went after the birthplace of labor, which was Wisconsin. So I think that actually played into the hands of the unions, played into the hands of our show, because it helped shed a light on it. And I think that the conversation is right now in this country that it's the have and the have-nots, and we don't want it. But I do think, and getting back to your question, I do wish that we had had more involvement by National Democrats, and I think there's still plenty of time to do it. And I think it's going to be crucial. I think this is the narrative for 2012. Whose side are you on? Are you for the workers, or are you for the top 2%?
And finally, Ed, what do you think President Obama's greatest challenges are going forward? It seems as if he's confronted with one unexpected crisis after another.
Well, moving forward on a number of different fronts, I think that the base, which he has frustrated. Healthcare is 1 year old today. We're going to do a story tonight on the show about all the outrageous comments that were made a year ago when the healthcare bill was passed and all of the fear-mongering that has taken place. None of it's come to fruition. So the president, he's driving a steady ship with as many things that are being thrown at him. But I think he is going to be able to go back and say, we have made movement, positive movement on the progressive front. It may not be as the way you want it, but this is how Washington moves. I think the base is going to understand the obstruction that took place in the last session of Congress. I think these Republican governors have absolutely taken the mask off the real Republican Party, which I think is going to motivate a lot of basers. So I think the president, you know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I think that he will be able to come back and get a good portion of his base understanding. May not be with the same excitement that they had before, but understanding that what's at stake here is some real grave consequences. I think the president will have labor. He will have wage earners. I think that he will be able to make the case to independent voters that the Bush tax cuts, the Republicans got exactly what they wanted. The Republicans are developing a ledger right now in the Congress that they are not focused on jobs, that they are going the social agenda, that they're doing ridiculous things by trying to defund NPR. I mean, come on. That's not where the unemployed is. That's not where small business is. That's not where the taxation of the country is. And I think the Democrats will be able to bounce back with some good, consistent conversation with the American people and a better priority list.
Ed Schultz, host of MSNBC's The Ed Show. Thanks so much for your time today, Ed.
Jason, good to be with you anytime. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue with our look back on 2011 with Congresswoman Karen Bass.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more. Visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congresswoman Karen Bass from California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Joining us today, of course, from the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's annual legislative conference, the 41st conference. Tell us what you're doing here this week.
Well, it's always exciting to be a part of CBC Week, but this is my first time being a part of it as a member. So going to the various workshops and preparing for my own workshop that begins in a couple of hours at 2 p.m., and the title of the workshop is The Rise and Fall and Rise Again of the Black Middle Class.
Tell us about that. Tell us about the rise and fall and the rise again of the Black Middle Class.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's a workshop that we're doing in collaboration with labor. And so Bill Lucy, legacy labor leader, is going to be the moderator. And Arlene Holt from the AFL will be there. Dr. Spriggs from the Department of Labor will be there, as well as two young labor leaders, LaFonza Butler from SEIU Home Care Workers, as well as Phaedra will be there for Green for All. So the rise and fall, we're looking at public sector workers. You know, when you talk about the attacks on public sector workers that is happening all over our country and in various states, you are talking about jobs that African Americans hold. I mean, it was one of the victories of the civil rights movement that African Americans even broke into the public sector. And of course, what's being talked about in Washington on a daily basis is the post office, letter carriers. My father was a letter carrier for 37 years. It's the reason why I'm sitting here today, because my dad was a union employee who had a pension, who had health care, and was able to provide for our family. So if you're talking about eliminating and attacking the public sector, you are talking about attacking jobs that African Americans hold.
How do we then go about bringing up this rise again to getting people back to where they need to be?
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons why LaFonce Butler is here as a young labor leader looking at the health care sector of our economy. When the Affordable Care Act was passed a couple of years ago, you're talking about extending coverage to 30 million Americans. Well, who's going to provide the health care? We really have to build the workforce, and we need to make sure that when that workforce is built, that it is organized, that it is union workers. And so she's going to be here talking about the future. And then with Phaedra talking about green for all, we're talking about the green economy, where you are meaning a new sector of our economy. Well, frankly, African Americans need to, one, be employers and create the businesses. And then also African-Americans need to be the employees. So from two points of view. But if you look at the American Jobs Act that the president is putting forward within Congress a couple of weeks ago, he's talking about billions of dollars of infrastructure money. Well, billions of dollars of money for infrastructure, you're talking about jobs. You're talking about union jobs. But one thing about the African-American community, though, is that we have to fight to make sure that we're actually on those work sites. So that's why it's the rise and fall, but a rise again of the black middle class.
Now, you have mentioned a couple of times here the role that unions will play in this rise again. Talk
exactly.
about how important that is to have strong union jobs being created in this country.
Well, and I think that we have all seen if we don't have union jobs, then, you know, you're not talking about health care and you're certainly not talking about pensions. Coming from Los Angeles, the United Commercial Food Workers just finished settling a potential strike that fortunately was averted. What was the reason for that strike? It was health care. Without unions fighting on behalf of workers, there wouldn't have been a fight over health care at all. Health care just would have been eliminated. And so to me, that's the reason. We have to not just have any job, but we have to be able to have a job where you can afford to support yourself. It doesn't serve anybody to have a job and have to live in your car because you can't afford to pay rent or own a home.
Congresswoman, you had talked about creating jobs and bringing up this middle class. Why is there such an attack on public workers? Why is there an attack on public workers at a time when the economy needs jobs, needs to be creating jobs, not eliminating jobs?
Well, I think we're in an ideological battle within our country, frankly, and there's some people that don't believe we need the public sector. Why don't we just privatize everything? If we're going to privatize Social Security, why don't we privatize schools? Why don't we privatize our roads? Why don't we privatize everything? And so that's the battle. What do you use the national treasure for? What do you use tax resources for? Do you use it to give money to corporations? Do you use it to finance wars? So we are in an ideological battle within our country, and we need to be very clear. This shouldn't be personal. This is about ideology, and I think that we have to be very clear to say that we have values in our country, and those values we need to fight for. And the public sector, in my opinion, is a part of the values of our nation.
Talk a little bit about the importance of public sector workers and the services that they provide the general public.
I think that this is something that all of us have fallen behind on. I don't think that we've done enough. I don't think I've done enough as an elected official. I don't think the labor movement has done enough to really educate people as to what the public sector is. So it's so funny. In California, we had budget cutbacks. People, oh, let's get rid of the government workers. And then they got mad when the Department of Motor Vehicles wasn't open. They got mad when there was a accident on the freeway and it took extra time to clear the accident. Why? Because the governor had furloughed the Caltrans, which are the workers for the roads, the highways in California. They had furlough Fridays, so there weren't enough of them. So I think that all of us should participate in educating the general public as to what the work the public sector does. So if you need to call 911, who do you think is going to answer that phone? It's not going to be a company. It's the public sector that answers that phone. And so I think that we all could contribute more there.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Congresswoman Karen Bass. Congresswoman, what are some of the consequences of cutting back on public service? I know you mentioned a little bit about 911 and furlough Fridays in California.
Well, in California, we've had layoffs of tens of thousands of teachers. We've had firefighters laid off. And in California, every summer, we have a problem with wildfires. At one point in time when I was in the state legislature, We were fighting 1,000 wildfires, and I was not able to, we were not able to get our Republican colleagues to vote to fund fire service. Well, in affluent rural areas, they pay for their fire service. So I think, you know, when the Republicans talk about class warfare, I do think that there's a level of class warfare that's going on, but I don't think it's coming from the side of the Democrats, frankly. When you were talking about defunding the public sector, then you were talking about then only those who have a level of affluence where they don't need the public sector because they can pay for any of the services that the public sector does.
In the press, we hear the back and forth about what should be done to revive the economy. But when you're on the job and you're working with your colleagues in the House, are they receptive to the idea that public sector workers and the value that they provide is something that's needed in this country?
Well, I think with my Republican colleagues, they're not, because they believe in downsizing government. But, you know, I have, as I've gotten to know my Republican colleagues over the years, not just in Congress, but in the state legislature, some of them absolutely understand. But unfortunately, a lot of times the Republicans operate under threat. And that threat is from Rush Limbaugh. That threat is from Grover Norquist. That threat is from talk radio in specific areas. And so I think that we at some point have to figure out how to address that.
And do you see the labor movement as really a driver behind addressing those issues?
Well, I absolutely see the labor movement as a driving force. But, you know, I come from, prior to being in office, not the labor movement. I come from a community organizing social justice background. And one of the things that we do in the Los Angeles area that I hope takes place across the country, but I don't know, is a collaboration, a strategic alliance between the labor movement and community organizations that are not necessarily represented by labor.
What's your reaction to President Obama's plan to reduce the deficit and to pay for his Jobs Act?
Well, I think that his plan to reduce the deficit, especially by restoring some of the taxes that had been cut during the Bush years, is exactly what we need to do. Although it's being advertised as a tax hike, it's restoring what was rewarded during times when the economy was better. We need those resources back. You know, I mentioned one of the panelists that's going to be speaking, Phaedra Ellis Lampkins. She's the CEO of Green for All. And when we're talking about green jobs and the economy, the president also talked about that, too. The way to reduce the deficit is by getting people back to work. That's the number one way to reduce the deficit. And so Phaedra is going to be coming to the panel talking about the economy moving forward, and that's an investment that the president has put a lot of resources and a lot of energy into.
How has that gone in your district? Are you seeing an increase in the opportunity for green jobs for people to take?
Well, yes, because, you know, coming from California and in Los Angeles, we've definitely been at the forefront of the green economy and energy efficiency and all of that. And so we have a mayor in Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, who wants to make Los Angeles the greenest city in the country. And so because of that, and because of very specific organizing efforts that have taken place with organizations like Scope in the South Central area and Lane, those are two organizations in LA that collaborate strategically with labor to fight for those green jobs. IBEW is very active in that arena in the Los Angeles area. So I think we actually are quite a bit ahead of the country.
In addition to some of these issues that you're fighting for now, what else is on your plate, on your agenda to move Los Angeles forward?
Well, to move Los Angeles forward, the first thing we have to address is jobs in any way possible. And so fighting for the transportation money, you know, California and Los Angeles in particular is very much car dependent. And so we have to fight for those dollars, transportation dollars, to come in. We're building light rail in Los Angeles. We need to have high-speed rail in the state. So specifically, that's what's on my agenda.
What kind of impact would light rail and the high-speed rail have on the driving community in Los Angeles?
Well, you know what? It is nothing for us to get in the car and know we have to take an hour to go someplace. California and Los Angeles over the years, we used to have rush hour. We don't have rush hour anymore. It's all the time.
Congresswoman Karen Bass from California, we appreciate your time so much. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you to our guests this week, Americans for Democratic Action National Director Michael J. Wilson, MSNBC's Ed Schultz, and Congresswoman Karen Bass.
I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by...